Straight Jack, episode 16. We will review three films, one new release, one pre-2000, one post-2000, and there will be a theme based on the film that was chosen that is out in cinemas now. And this week, the new release was selected by James.
As the listeners will remember from the last podcast, was Taika Waititi's follow-up to What We Do in the Shadows, Hunt for the Wilder People. So I suppose to set it up, after tragedy strikes very early on, a very disgruntled Sam Neill, well, Sam Neill's character, and a troubled child find themselves on a hike and inadvertently on the run from the law. And that indeed was our theme, On the Run.
Kicking off the film, the first 6 minutes are some of the most hilarious 6 minutes for any film I've seen. It's genuinely...
That's what the director wants.
It's genuinely...
6 minutes tops.
It was so funny. I mean, it wasn't... Okay, maybe more than 6 minutes. But
I've been... First,
well, no,
you've been
very specific by saying...
Very, very specific.
Is there a cut point?
What happens in the seventh? You don't want to know. No, the opening 20 or so is absolutely stunning. I was laughing heartedly. And I'm the kind of guy who...
Very everybody wants some.
Yes.
In the same, it just comes at you with the comedy full throttle before going into the dramatic aspect. Is that what sort of happens? Obviously, there is a tragedy and then the movie does turn. Does it completely stop the comedy, though, for you?
I'm not sure if that's what happens or if the comedy just gets old.
Yeah.
Because the first 20 minutes, I'm laughing at them and I'm laughing at kind of their accents, but the humour is of a certain ilk.
Yeah.
Then after the 20 minutes, maybe it does just get old. What did you think?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of... I mean, What We Do in the Shadows, as much as they were great characters, it was all in the accent and the way he said, Buschetti. Like, the way... The New Zealand accent, it is just hilarious to us.
It has got that Flight of the Conchords delivery, doesn't it? Just really deadpan. No one realises any of it's funny, but everything is hilarious.
But you look at these two and you've got... Why is it still funny? You've got the little chubby kid with all of his trendy new clothes on, and you've got Sam Neill, like, very much, you know, the older generation. He does things. He can't even read, is that right? Or he can't...
That is great. He's very...
And these two couldn't be further from each other. And just looking at, just visually, how they are up against each other is already hilarious.
Mm.
And then when they burst into such gems as... Ricky Baker should have been a number one, that one. But
apparently, I don't know if you guys heard this as well, but apparently they didn't have the rights to the Happy Birthday song, so she made that up.
Just improvised.
She made it up as an improvise, and they kept it in. Apparently.
Well, I'm pretty glad they did, because it is absolutely... watching that particular clip back on the YouTube, you just realise how standalone just that little moment. That almost encapsulates the entire film for me, because whereas What We Do in the Shadows was an all-out comedy and comfortably one of the best of 2 years ago now, I guess. It wasn't quite last year.
Yeah.
I guess
two or three years ago, wasn't it?
2 years.
Was it?
I think it was a Kickstarter project as well, wasn't it?
Right.
Really had no money towards it.
Because all of his films have been fairly... I mean, Eagle vs. Shark is frightfully low budget, and Boy as well.
Mm.
Obviously not a lot of money spent, but... Whereas, What We Do in the Shadows is all an out-and-out comedy. Here, in that song, you've got... This is a... I would call it a dramedy. Would you agree, disagree?
Yeah, I think it seems to be... There is a spectrum of comedy at one end and drama at the other end, for this film, not just in general. And I think it goes back and forth within it. I think, for me, the comedy... I completely agree with Robbie. Maybe not specifically honing in on the 6 minutes.
But 6 minutes, 21.
Yeah, the start, because it's something new and you're laughing at the locale of it all, because they are trying to be, just like Fargo, they really play on sort of the Minnesotan element to it. This really plays on the Kiwi element.
It warms you in, and it does setting and who these people are inherently followed.
And you find that, but then it's not a TV show, it's a film. So after a while, you're used to that and the jokes around that and the jokes that are inherently linked to being... You know, from New Zealand, I found didn't make me laugh. And for me, I suppose this film never really got me out of a little sort of sniff and a chuckle, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I never absolutely bellowed and laughed out loud. A lot of the time, it was just a case of, you know, a little smile or a smirk, and then every now and then a little chuckle, but nothing more than that.
That's how I usually am. But this genuinely had me laughing
out loud. That's good.
I was so excited for the whole film. I was
all of it. You had that all of it.
Well, no, I was excited from the first 6 minutes. I was so excited to see where this was going, and it did just sort of peter out. But it's not just the comedy. the opening 6 minutes. Yeah. The opening of the film starts off really quite. There's loads of quick cuts and it's all quite. There's loads
Edgar
of
Wrighty,
Edgar Wrighty, I thought. Yeah. And Wes Andersony. There was a lot of symmetry and a lot of.
There's a lot of Moonrise Kingdom. Moonrise Kingdom. Absolutely. I think we all saw that.
But it just loses its way, not just with the comedy.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real shame.
Do you think, because I think there certainly is a turning point where, sort of like you say, you just get used to it and it not wears thin, but then you're like, what has it got? And like a lot of films, there is a middle bit where it almost is transitioning from, I don't know if it is as jarring as I'm making it out to be, but from the comedy into right now, we've got this relationship that we're going to focus on and it's going to be all about, they're obviously going to not get on at first and we all know eventually they probably will get on. And it's just in that sort of transition, I think it does sort of lull, I'd say is fair. But I would also say there is light at the end of the tunnel and it does come through where you are absolutely cheering for both these characters, even though they're not, to be fair, from the start, that likeable, really. I mean, we laugh at them, but as characters, Sam Neill's just a bit of a grump and he's just a bit of a spoil. You see in his garb, like he's just wants to play on his iPhone and be a current kid, which we hate anyway, because
given his background, we're supposed to sympathise with him, or you would expect us to be sympathising with him, but you don't really, because he does come across a bit of a brat, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But I think we talked about chemistry a lot when we talked about Hello High Water, and regardless of your feelings towards that, but when I think about
let's not open up that can of worms.
Stitches are still. Anyway, I think for me, the chemistry between these two, you've already said, you know, the generational difference between these two is vast, but they did have good chemistry, and that was where most of the comedy came from. I think for me, the film, it's a relatively cliched story, but they tried to spin it in a rather unique way, and a lot of that uniqueness was around from New Zealand and the little quirks and the little nuances of being from New Zealand. And for me, after the first however many minutes that we want to declare it, I think for me then that sort of dried. It didn't dry out, but I dried out from it, I suppose.
See, this is where then it sort of picked up again on another level as it started to sort of not quite genre shift, but obviously the theme is outlaw. And then when it sort of does become this, quite unexpectedly how far they do push it, this Thelma and Louise, this Bonnie and Clyde is probably more the classic. There are a few scenes where you're like, this could go. There were moments where I thought it was going to be Sightseers, and it was. It certainly isn't quite that. Doesn't have that quite that degree of bite to it in the end. But it certainly heads in some quite an interesting direction. But are we still focused on the midpoint and saying that, you know, we had the laughs, a little bit unsure, and then
the predictable ending.
We had like, but I think they got the ending so. So right, it was such a warm, fuzzy feeling. I think that, I don't know if that was because the ending was so good, or if it was just that actually watching these two, they were cold to each other. Watching them steadily learn and adapt, and just, you know, almost begrudgingly become these friends. Seeing that at the end, those two together, it's kind of.
I think
that was enough for me anyway.
Yeah, it's predictable, but that's not necessarily said in a bad way.
No,
it needed the ending that it had. There's no other way you could have ended it. But yeah, for me, it did just sort of peter out, I think.
Yeah.
From such a strong start to an okay middle, and then to a satisfactory ending.
Satisfactory is the perfect word for it, I think, because tonally it absolutely suits what the rest of the film is going for. And I suppose when I said about it being unique, I thought it was a unique take, and yet I couldn't help but feel I'd still seen it all before.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in terms of obviously the uniqueness of the New Zealand culture behind it, but more a case of, you know, the actual plot. And as you said, you know, the very satisfying ending and predictable ending that we probably all knew was going to happen. But it still pulls on the heartstrings a bit. So it still shows that you were emotionally invested in it. And I would challenge anyone not to be emotionally invested in this story and the couple that we are saying, you know, that we're on the run.
It leaves a smile. And I think that was what was the desired impact at the start. It was probably to have a laugh, you know, show this. I think it's probably the most realised of Waititi's. I think this is what, because Eagle versus Shark, I thought was absolutely dreadful, so deadpan it stopped still. It was like a poor man's Napoleon Dynamite. Boy, again, it's the same New Zealand-based humour, but it wasn't quite as, there wasn't as that much going on in the story. And then What We Do, he's done something a bit quite interesting. I think here he's brought that sort of interesting element into this kind of very warm, fuzzy kind of New Zealand culture. And I think this is definitely the film he set out to make. And I think he's got certainly a very bright future if he just keeps making sort of films with this kind of control and doing his thing. He will make a lot of very original and, I think, very lovely, interesting films.
Well, you say that. His follow-up, so his next film is the Thor.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, it's the next Thor film. Which,
well, that is a question.
Isn't particularly unique. Yeah, and isn't I imagine the studio will have far more to say in that than perhaps...
Oh, we'll do an Edgar Wright, we'll leave. How are we feeling?
I'll kick us
what
off.
What are we going for?
I selected it. I would give it a 3. I think probably because of all the reasons I've already mentioned, I thought it had some absolute positives and it was a very enjoyable, satisfying film to watch. But it wasn't as unique as I think it was trying to be. I didn't feel it offered anything new to my experience of watching those kind of films. But I still enjoyed it. I'd still recommend it. But it just didn't do anything that deserved anything more than sort of a medium 3 for me.
I'm going to go for a 4, which is, I mean, I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt in the first part where it's really funny, and it does, it is heartwarming, but I don't know, it's nowhere near a 5. It's a low 4 for me.
I was kind of in the middle, and then, yeah, I'm also a 4, but certainly not a high 4. It doesn't do enough.
It did feel
radically different, but it, yeah, still satisfying, exactly what I thought it would be. Did what it set out to achieve, so
it does feel original, though, I thought. But maybe I just haven't seen anything else like it.
No, but it's weird because I would say it felt original and cliched all at the same time. Like I felt like it was new, but I'd seen it all before.
Yeah,
and I know that's a weird contradiction, but it felt like it was trying to be unique, and some of it felt unique, and yet I couldn't help but feel this is nothing new, even though I don't know how to describe it.
Because the way it was repackaged, like you almost had like the social services element was. Kind of that Moonrise Kingdom actually, element. I mean, like, that was interesting.
Can we talk about her? She was infuriated. I mean, I know she was designed to be.
She was just that. Yeah, no, but I liked how unlikable she... I enjoyed how unlikable she
was.
The Bourne Identity. So, an unconscious American is found floating in the sea by a group of fishermen who haul him up onto their boat. He soon realises he has 2 bullet holes in his back and not a clue of who he is or how he got there. Matt Damon, who plays the starring role, spends the rest of the film trying to discover his past self and also figure out why there are people chasing after him.
What a premise.
Yeah. That's its strength, I think, for me.
That's
the best thing about the film.
Absolutely.
And that's not belittling, because we'll go on to it, but that's not belittling some of the other really good things about this film. But for me, that premise, I think, distinguishes it from some of the other generic films that we've reviewed on this
90%
show.
90% of other action spy films of the time, definitely.
I would say, before we get into premise, and I don't think it was a negative thing, but amnesia can be a really easy trope, and it can be sort of...
Excuses a lot.
The audience doesn't know who this guy is, and neither does he, and therefore you're going to find out over the next 2 hours as he finds out, and it's quite easy to... set a character on the journey of self-discovery and let it unfold. It builds so much intrigue before any word is said, really.
Yeah.
But that's the ironic thing here, because to start with, it's absolutely like that. But then actually we find out more than he does. So we learn who he is before he learns who he is.
Right.
So that's what, again, was quite interesting, because you are almost he's working backwards, whereas we're far more in the know than he is. In usual spy thrillers, we don't know anything. We're finding out as they're finding out, so they find out who the murderer is. It's like, oh my God, we're all in this together, whereas in this, we know his history because we see
it's
those
the
people who are
government
tracking him.
That bank scene is quite superb, where he just sort of goes into his little booth and he uncovers. And I think at that point, we're not that privy, because that's fairly early on, and you're like, what? And it's that very much with you, I think, with you there, Robbie, like where you're like, what would you do? What on earth could this be? Yeah. And then I think, obviously, then when you get to the middle act, then you do start to go, right, okay. We see the people who are going after him. We also see sort of like there's the subplot. And then obviously we see other things that obviously bring more stuff to light. And then we go, right, okay, let's see how he deals with this.
So why were you guys saying it was a good premise if it is such an easy narrative to kind of pick up and do?
Because I think in most of the time, usually in these kind of films, there's some adversity and then the spy wins by doing something crazy like the spy does. You know, you look at, what is it, Jack Ryan? Is it Jack Ryan? Jack Reacher? Bond, for example. There's always a typical villain. There's always a typical target. There's some adversity or an obstacle that the spy has to get over. And it just so happens they do because they're so damn cool and good looking. Whereas in this, it's, you know, he's learning. I suppose we're seeing as he's learning. And, you know, it's almost like there's all these puzzle pieces on the floor and he's sort of picking them up and putting them into place, and we're almost watching him do that. But we've got not quite, we've got an almost, we've got a further advanced puzzle where we've seen some of the pieces are already put together.
We're screaming at the screen, they're going there,
exactly,
go,
yeah, exactly. And for me, I think that's the difference with some of those other films. It does have very much an A, B, C, D to Z kind of thing. We all know what's going to happen, whereas with this, it's all jumbled around, and we are learning, of course, but it's the fact that we're watching him learn. I think that's the thing. I think that's the credit to Matt Damon as well, because
perfect casting.
He plays it so well.
Because he balances that sort of clinical assassin, which he absolutely is, and you can tell inherent within him, regardless of how confused he is, he's still got that. There's that scene where he's at that diner, he says, you know, I can tell you the number plates of every single one of the cars outside. How can I do that? I can tell that the guy at the bar is this heavy.
The vulnerability in his eyes in that scene.
Exactly. Sort of. And that's the thing. He combines that perfect clinical assassin with the vulnerability of someone who is just utterly confused and afraid of what he is, what his history is, what he's done. And when as he begins to understand, there is that moral dilemma of, what did I do? What did I used to be? Am I still that? Why did I make that decision in the first place? And for me, that was just fascinating. And he absolutely played that perfectly. And I think this was probably the film that made him. I know Good Will Hunting at School Ties, obviously.
I think this has opened him up certainly to franchises. He would then go on to do all of these big, once he handled this, he went on to do all the big Hollywood stuff. But was this, do you know at all, is this like quite a modest budget? It doesn't feel, there is, could call it an explosion, but this is not a film based on big effects and big explosions. All the set pieces are kind of just really good sort of navigation, hand-to-hand combat. There's a better chase in a mini than the remake of The Italian Job.
I mean, it was
low key to an extent for an action film.
Yeah,
It felt on a big scale because you had obviously the government in America. You had obviously all of these various cities in Europe that were being utilised, and it felt expansive. Especially sort of his journey, and it is kind of a road movie to an extent. It's him sort of meandering round, and you do get this real vast sense of no matter where he goes, they're always, and even at the end you're like, they're still, you're little, you think you probably know there's going to be a sequel even when we all saw it when it sort of came out. But yeah, it's there's a lot going on here that deserves commending because it is so different to a lot of the similar stuff that was out at the moment. I think,
can we just dwell on the car chase scene just for a second as well? Because that is great. And you talk about not a particularly big budget, the way of doing it. Like, apparently that was shot by the second unit director as well, so it wasn't even like a key scene. It was just, they just were sort of throwing little sort of pickup shots together, and that one just seemed to sort of come out of it, which is pretty impressive itself. There's one scene, and I hope you recognised it, but it was very near the start where Brian Cox and maybe Chris Cooper are having a chat in a cafeteria or a canteen, and my god, it's the most green screen thing I've ever seen. I mean, it looks so dated, it's ridiculous. They're supposed to be in this like really long cafeteria, presumably in like a CIA building in Langley or whatever it is, and it looks so bad, it's terrible, honestly. You're in a cafeteria, why? It's not exactly like a tricky scene to take, but I don't know why I picked up. That's the first thing I wrote down.
What was in the background?
No one. That's the whole point. It was just so. It was a completely empty room, but they clearly weren't in there. But again, maybe
you've got gripes.
Yeah, I have about that. Pedantic as hell. But
see, I didn't pick up on that, and very much to how I think we spoke about 28 Days Later a few episodes ago. Like, I think it's aged well because it was around the same time, so it's sort of near getting on for 15 years old now, and I'd still find this so much more accessible, and I find this it just feels intelligent compared to a lot of other action films and these sort of big government.
And for me, the reason why it feels like that is because they get the balance perfectly right between action and just kind of your straightforward human talking
You are absolutely quite right, because then you've got all this stuff going on, but then you've got obviously the shots in America where in the offices where it's all getting very sort of fractured, and you can see these, is it Chris Cooper pretty much, who's like almost clutching at straws, and you can see things around him, you can see them all sort of very frenetic and they're all sort of panicking. But then, yeah, the two, as they are just driving along, just sort of discovering, and you look at him and you think, is he a Terminator? Is he a robot? And that I mean, it's a wonderful scene where she's sort of like, oh, actually, he's put my life at risk, but he seems like a good guy. And he's sort of like, you're like, oh, he is a robot. And then, but then they share a few moments, and I think they are quite touching when he sort of realizes, oh, I might not know who I am, but at least I am a good person. You know, he doesn't go around killing, blowing people's heads off. He only kills people when he has to. Yeah. He'll just try and do the classic, just try and knock them out, get them out of the way, but he knows deep down he is a good person, and when she sees that too, it does bring a really nice element that all of these other big budget films totally bypass. They are, no one wants that. I mean, maybe it's just us who
just want more explosions.
Perhaps we're not the main audience, but other people would complain and say exactly that. But for me,
yeah,
that's what makes it
definitely
such a far more well-rounded affair.
But I think when we've already touched upon, you know, Matt Damon, but just Jason Bourne in general is so much more of a sympathisable character than Bond,
well, like
Reacher,
saying,
and all those people are. And I think that's one of the differences. You actually emotionally invest in these films, whereas otherwise you are looking for the superficial explosions and all the more action-packed stuff that, to be fair, a lot of people would prefer.
Yeah.
And, you know, every now and then I'm happy to watch those kind of films because they satisfy a certain criteria of what you go for when you go and see a film.
Yeah.
But I think Robbie, I think you're absolutely right when you think about there are actually quite a few storylines in this that they do very well to balance all of them, because you've got Julia Stiles' character who's a bit detached from everything. You've got Clive Owen who and some of the other assassins
as
well.
And he is so good. Clive Owen is brilliant.
I love Clive Owen.
He's got about four lines.
Chris Cooper and Brian Cox. And you've just got so many different storylines there. They do very well to balance in terms of both the quality of those scenes. They're not just filler, so you're not seeing Bourne the whole time. Mm-hmm. They actually contribute towards the story. And just the casting is great as well. We've already touched upon Clive Owen. That fantastic scene towards the end in the meadow and things like that.
It just feels like that's where, when you're so invested in these characters, and that is, when you watch those other films, you sort of, it's just loud, quiet, loud, how to write a classic rock song. And these other things, like, oh, 300 is a perfect example. We've done loads of deaths, all this. Let's just do people talking. It doesn't matter what they're saying, it's irrelevant. But here, you actually think they've sat down with an actual writer and actually gone, yeah, let's bring all of these elements, let's weave it all together and actually make even characters like Julia Stiles, who has such a minor role, Clive Owen, such a minor role, Chris Cooper, to it, not quite as minor, but very little to actually do. Yeah, you do feel like they do exist, and they are offering something to the table, I guess.
It's the human element for me that's done so well. You do usually see these trained assassins in films, and you know, they might have a love interest here or there, like James Bond does. Has a different girl every
Leon.
Film.
That's a gimmick now, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
James Bond. Yeah.
But then
Bond
with this, girl. Even everyone's in with this. Is it the Treadstone? Initiative, I'll call it. And when they're all sort of called up, they're all doing something so mundane. Like, I think Clive Owen's taking his kids to school, and there's a couple of others who are just kind of relaxing on holiday. And then they just get a call and they're, bang, you have to go kill someone. And it makes you realise, like, well, with Bourne, we're seeing the human elements in so much more depth, but every single one of them is just like him, really. And they probably all act in the same way if they're in his shoes.
It's just that he's obviously so good that he was a. I mean, obviously there is that level, that degree of not unbelievability, but like in all the Bonds, you know, he's always going to sort of take out all of the sort of the simple, the droogs, take all the, like, the henchmen are going down in 2 seconds. You know, he's not going to get caught out by these people, and he will. You know, he's always going to get through to the end, but it's done in a more refined way than a lot of others.
I read, I think it was on Wikipedia, that they either auditioned, screen tested, or thought of Brad Pitt, Stallone, Arnie, Russell Crowe, and Tom Cruise for this role. And you just think,
wow.
And this is a testament to Matt Damon. I can't see anyone else playing this role other than Matt Damon now. And yes, he's done 4 films of Bourne, but I try and substitute them into Jason Bourne. I mean, Stallone and Arnie, I mean, that would just be...
At the time, they were more bankable and they were
But you could see the sort of film that would have been if it had been Arnie or Stallone. It wouldn't have been the vulnerable Jason Bourne.
No, no.
You wouldn't get that, really. I mean, Pitt to an extent, but... Yeah.
But Russell Crowe and Tom Cruise... Tom Cruise more so, because when you do look at some of his roles, he's got more versatility than his, you know, his action... His Mission Impossible film suggests he has.
Yeah.
When I think about, like, Jerry Maguire, and even actually more recently... Edge of Tomorrow.
Edge of Tomorrow.
Where he
which is the same director as Bourne Identity, yeah. It's the same.
Didn't know that. Thanks for that.
Yeah. What we got here is just a real solid, real satisfying spy crime thriller. And it's just four stars. It's not Heat, you know, it's not a masterpiece, but it does what it does. Very much like The Wilder People, and it leaves you satisfied you've watched the film that you thought you were gonna see.
I second both the comments and the rating, 4.
I think, yeah, gets perfect balance of action film. You've got your gripping, your exciting, your tense moments in this film, but you also have your endearing and really touching moments, which you don't usually get in an action film. I too am going to go with a 4.
Full House 4.
And now on to my choice. Is Starman, 1984, John Carpenter. We have start with a sobbing Karen Allen, who we gather has recently lost her house painter husband, and then there is a beam of light, and in through the window comes some sort of force, some otherworldly existence that manages to, weirdly, it is weird, she's kept pictures in the photo album and strands of hair, which are able to be turned, the DNA is able to be turned by this extraterrestrial into a living, walking, talking Jeff Bridges.
Looking absolutely banging in this
absolutely film. Absolutely superb, so good. But he is lacking the Jeff Bridges charisma. This is This is an alien. This is a robot. This is what's going on. She's gone to the next room. She's heard a rumble. What are you doing here? You're definitely dead. And yeah, he says, "No, I'm here. I'm from another place. I got 3 days. You're gonna drive me to see my mates. Let's get on with this." She's dumbfounded, but says yes. Film, John Carpenter, sci-fi, follow up to E.T. and Close Encounters. It's just. Lovely stuff. Sorry, no.
Midnight Special as well. I'm so glad that you brought up Midnight Special.
Disclaimer, just say this film was selected primarily due to the template. The skeleton of the film is that of the best film of this year so far, Midnight Special. Mm. And I was interested to know whether the negative responses received on this podcast about 10 episodes ago was down to the genre, the elements at play, or if it was just a personal attack on Jeff Nichols. Robbie, how did you feel about Starman?
About Starman?
Starman.
I enjoyed Starman.
Oh.
But it is. You said it was the skeleton of...
Yeah.
I'd say it's a lot more than that. There's taking a narrative and then there's taking the mickey. This is almost Midnight Special to a T.
Midnight Starman.
It's Midnight Special rewrapped. That's exactly what it is. However, it's much, much better. I didn't care at all about Midnight Special. I really, really, really cared about Jeff Bridges here. I wanted him, in more ways than one.
Thank gosh.
I really, really wanted to see him get home.
Yeah. You've fallen for him. That was so sweet. Can we just replay that a few times? More or less so than E.T.
I thought he was funny, despite having the blankest face that you've ever seen in a film ever.
But
yeah,
but he gets better. He gets, you know, he loosens up a bit, right?
He does, yeah.
Well, oh well. Yeah.
And he acts the part really well. Do you think?
He does. I agree. I made that noise earlier because, you know, Jeff Bridges he's a good looking chap, but he has so much charisma
to burn.
And in this. He tries to get it through, but he can't really because just that's the role that he's playing. He can't really get charisma through because the whole point is that he can't be charismatic. He's funny because it's situational comedy, isn't it? It's the idea that he's saying things that he shouldn't be saying, or he's replicating what other people have said for comic effect.
It's almost his Rain Man.
It's that kind of role, isn't it? Yeah. But, I mean, you talk about the transformation scene. That looked incredible. For the time that this film was done,
superb.
For what I mean, it doesn't. I'm not sure if it's one shot because I think it might keep panning back
to
Karen.
It does cut away. Yeah.
But the way he sort of morphs and grows, that's just. I thought that was amazing. I couldn't believe that this was a. You say 85 or 82?
84. Yeah.
Well, if it's 84, then maybe not.
In the ballpark. Yeah.
This is classic 84 territory. But there's quite an obvious character in this who's trying to be that. I love extraterrestrials. I'm really interested in it. And for me, that's probably my only gripe with this film, really. He had this cigar, right? And to try and give it this perception that this guy is some renegade. Like, look at this guy's badass, man. I mean, he likes extraterrestrials, but he's got a cigar, so back off. But then it just goes missing for, like, the majority of the film. And then at the end, he gets it back. It's like, oh, phew, he's still himself. He's still the maverick that we knew he was.
He saves the day. He's great.
Oh, my God.
No, because I like that, because it plays against the cigar. I love that. It plays against type. He's not just the usual frail nerd. I just sit in the lab all day.
But
and then
he
go
is.
Home and watch X-Files.
They just give him the cigar.
Did you not see the way he handled that cigar? Superb.
But no, I think when we come back to the main part of it, I mean, there's a scene where I think this is exactly where, you know, he asks her. First of all, she has a beautiful voice, by the way.
Karen
her
Allen.
Voice is incredible.
And dimple chin.
He says, you know, define love. And at that point, you're like, okay, I know where this film is going now. It was very clear from that point. This was like, okay, well, this is the direction of the film that we're going in now.
But did you expect how far it did go with it? Because I was genuinely caught off guard towards the end.
I think for me, this film is incredibly silly. I mean, it is so, so silly. It could have so easily been an absolutely terrible film.
Absolutely. It is on a knife edge.
But a big but. I was absolutely bought into it. I really did enjoy it. And as I say, the defined love bit, it takes that emotional turn that I didn't think it would take, and I certainly didn't think it would go in the direction that it did. I mean, not to put too many spoilers in here, but there is a very questionable sex scene. I I didn't know where to look with that sex scene. It was really bizarre.
You look at Jeff Bridges. That's where you look, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I was a bit confused about how they were attracted to one another, and I don't know. And then the whole baby thing and... I don't know. I was.
But when you think this is the guy who made all of these sort of like these very almost silly, but now you look back and you go, like a lot of his films from this period, you go, they're all classics. Like this is the guy that made The Thing.
Yeah.
Like he just loves this sort of. It is just so silly. And you can watch his films now and I guess at the time go, it's just some goofy little silly concept. This guy's having a laugh. How's he getting paid to do this? But the fact is at the end, and there are scenes like the parking lot and the reindeer scene, and you do feel, and which is the, just a, yeah, it's the reason why I liked Midnight Special and so much, is because that was a homage to scenes like this. In the car park, the scenes from E.T., scenes from Close Encounters, these warm, inexplainable, didn't that scene in the car park with the deer make you feel warm and fuzzy? It's just wonderful. And that was not, and that's excluding the human element. Yet again, this is the reason why all three of these films work, is because there is a central pairing that just have really good chemistry and that you genuinely believe, learn from one another. And although, all right, it's not an ideal situation initially, these three are all very similar in just how successful they are in making you care about them as a result of the journey.
And I've read into it way too much, unfortunately. And this is going to be conspiracy theory where you're all going to say, no, you're an idiot.
Here we go.
Karen Allen's finding it difficult to get over her husband at the start. So could the whole film not just be a sort of metaphor for her getting over her husband?
Events didn't happen. She's had too much to drink.
Maybe,
and just...
It doesn't happen, but maybe it is some sort of symbolic thing the director's thought about where,
what if you could have your dad come back?
When he first comes back, she just tries to lose him any way she can. She tries to escape, but she can't escape. She can't escape the fact that her husband's dead.
Okay.
And then in the end, she comes to terms with it. She embraces it.
Yeah,
and then sort of lets go.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely there.
Plausible, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Because that's
yes, yes.
No, wholeheartedly. Because that's that again. If to an extent, that's why I think this is probably a slightly richer, I would say, probably for my money, Bourne has the weakest of the three, the way you really are invested in their relationship, and I've still praised it. But here, yeah, you can see she's so in this throw, and she doesn't know how she feels, and she's obviously isn't a complete mess, but she still just goes with this completely bizarre situation. And yeah, can we just talk more about the sex scene?
It took me by surprise because I was so focused on the journey that Starman was going on and him getting home,
yeah,
that by the end I just didn't realise that I had gone on a journey with Karen Allen's character and the changes she had gone through,
yeah,
and how she had sort of developed as a person.
Yeah.
And it took me by surprise, and I thought it was really, really well done, despite its cheesiness.
I think everyone was, because this was 2 years after E.T., I believe, and everyone saw that sort of same year as Blade Runner, that flopped. What do we need? We need more friendly aliens. So who's friendlier than Jeff Bridges? We'll do this. And I think this was John Carpenter's first. I think this is a studio film. I believe it to be his first studio film. And there was like money involved. And everyone just thought, we're just going to make E.T. part two. Everyone will lap it up. But yeah, it's surprising, I think, almost how daring it is with some of these themes. You know, you've just got your dead husband in the car next to you. There's some risque stuff in there. And I just think it's very interesting how it... You don't realise until the end just how warmed you are to the situation, and yeah, you really do will him to go home.
And for me, I suppose the biggest compliment I can pay is that I was more interested in the emotional element of the relationship than I was the whole chase element of it, and I suppose what the end goal of it was really. Which very from the very beginning was him trying to get back to his motherland, I suppose. I mean, I'm not quite sure how to describe it, but basically trying to get back to his people, and there's a place he has to go to, and that's the whole point of them being on the run, I suppose. But I almost forgot that they were going towards that end, even though they signpost it a lot. I was more intrigued by where these two were going to go from an emotional point of view. And that's what I liked about it. As I say, I think this film could have gone so, so, so wrong. And don't get me wrong, the sex scene is so, 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 so wrong. But I think it does tread that line and does very well. I mean, for me, it did make me think at times, you know, how would you communicate with someone like that? Because he literally takes everything literally. So that does lead to some of the, for me anyway, the funniest moments in this film. Some of the best moments in this film are some of the little bits of comedy where he almost autistically takes... what she says literally about the traffic lights and the bingo and things like that. That was really funny. And for me, as I say, I think this film, I would have loved to, I didn't watch the trailer, but I would have really been intrigued to see how they marketed this film, because I reckon you could very easily package this film as a very standard sci-fi extraterrestrial film, whereas actually I think it offers so much more.
I think they focus, I believe in the trailer, they focus a lot less on the human element. It's more, yeah, let's show the setup with all the jazzy effects, let's show
the guy with the cigar,
let's show the big chase, and then some of the end, like it didn't focus on that. But yeah, as I think we've all agreed yet again, is that yeah, it is that human element that draws you in. And that's, for me, was where Midnight Special does something completely different, because that focuses a lot more on the chase. That focuses a lot, and it does that so exquisitely. And I believe the end reveal, nothing, not necessarily down to advancements in special effects, but the end of Midnight Special is jaw-dropping for a number of reasons, and catches you completely off guard if you're prepared to let it in.
But if you want to hear more about that, go back a few episodes.
But yeah, this does what it does very, very well. And again, I would give it a thoroughly enjoyable 4 stars.
I much preferred it to Midnight Special, but maybe I'm just the kind of person who needs that human element. And as you said, Midnight Special just didn't have it enough for me. I mean, obviously it was there. But yeah, I think it's a 3 stars. It does lull. It did lull for me. If it hadn't been for the weird sex scene, then it would have been really quite painful afterward. Yeah, that the human element pulls it through in the end. It's really effective at what it's trying to do, and you can't give a bigger compliment to a director than that, I wouldn't say.
No.
I think for me, I was borderline between 3 and 4, and I think just from discussing it with you two, I think it's reminded me how, you know, my fondness towards this film, and it's only grown in stature in my mind anyway. since I watched it. So for me, that's why it pushed it up to a 4. So, yeah. Lovely. So that was a very high scoring episode, really? Wasn't it?
And next week on Straight Jack, episode 17,
whose new
was
release?
My selection. Ooh,
was? Is
which
your...
One? Oh, it is my selection.
It is your... What are you
in
going
fact,
for, mate?
It is my selection.
It will be
I'm
your
allowed
selection.
To choose. I'm allowed to choose. Okay, I go for Swiss Army Man, the Flatulent Corpse movie. And I reckon from that, perhaps what I could do, because obviously we're all going to think of these films on the spot.
I thought you were going to go with All the Gifts. I didn't realise you were going to go for Swiss Army Man.
I'm going to go for Swiss Army Man.
Okay, all right. No,
and I
fine.
Think from that, from the trailer, I've gathered that maybe we could do a theme about odd couples. Is that okay?
Well, fair? James, you're on the.
Well, I know, but I prepared for Girl with All the Gifts. Let me have a think now. Let's go. Let the right one in. Let's go for the original. Let's go for the Swedish original.
Let the right one in.
Sorry,
in
guys. Case, I was just thrown off a little bit. There.
Yeah. In that case, I'm going to go for Beauty and the Beast. I think.
La Belle et la Bête.
No,
sounds
not
like you had that
Jean
one
Cocteau, 1946.
Absolutely not.
No,
the Disney 1991.
Yeah, fantastic.
Classic Beauty and the Beast. It's a musical, guys. So,
thank you for listening.
Oh, good.
I like your little beard.